Welcome to a DerivSource podcast on the unintended risks of a new OTC marketplace. I'm Julie Schieffer, the founder of DerivSource.com. The OTC derivatives marketplace is undergoing a radical transformation with the introduction of new regulatory rules and central counterparty clearing for some OTC instruments. To participate in this new derivatives landscape, financial institutions must change existing post-trade processing and risk management practices, but these practical changes require introduce additional risks for firms and financial market at large. In this DerivSource podcast, a panel will discuss the potential and unintended risks firms face with these new market developments, including new concerns for systemic risk, increased capital requirements, the cost and additional risk inherent in new collateral management practices, documentation, and counterparty risk management. With us today, we have Anu Munshi, partner at B&B Structured Finance, which is a provider of consulting advice and training on the financial markets with a specific expertise in structured products. We also have Andrew Hussar, a managing director in the U.S. and head of OTC derivatives client clearing at Morgan Stanley. Now, I'd like to begin by taking a big picture look here at some of the unintended consequences of this new OTC derivatives marketplace. And Anu, would you like to start and give us your concerns of the risks that we all have to face going forward?
Sure, Julia. I'd like to start by saying that there are some good initiatives in place for central clearing. But what I'd like to focus on here is the unintended risks. So starting with big picture, I'd say the key ones are concentration risk for a single CCP and reduced liquidity on bilaterally cleared derivatives. There are also specific risks such as counterparty credit risks and operational risks, which we'll delve into later in some detail. So in terms of concentration risk, currently ICE dominates CDS clearing and LCH dominates interest rate swap clearing through its interest rate swap clearing platform, SwapClear. These clearing houses currently face the key market participants, many of whom are dealers, who in turn act as clearing members for smaller market participants. So it's imperative that the risk management methods and systems put in place by the CCPs are stringent and robust, because the biggest risk to derivative markets is if the CCP fails. So it's now the CCP that's too big to fail. Unfortunately, the CCP's methods and systems are not widely known, including their stress testing, the size of their default funds, and how they operate. So for example, how big is the default fund effectively, and is it adequate if two or three large dealers default at or around the same time? This is the issue of systemic risk which CCPs are intended to address, but do we have sufficient information on whether they will operate as they're intended to? Are their risk management practices getting the same scrutiny as a large dealer would? Or is there a bit of complacency on this front, stemming from the comfort of a central counterparty with a lot of offsetting trades? And add to this the immense pressure from regulators and politicians for more derivatives to be cleared centrally and as soon as possible, when the CCPs are already working flat out on implementing what is a completely new way of operating for OTC derivatives. The risk I see is that CCPs are not ready to clear all the products they're supposed to clear, and that's a scary prospect, because if something goes wrong, it'll go wrong in a big way. It's in the CCP's interest to have as many products cleared through them as possible, but even the heads of CCPs have spoken out in the last year to caution against pushing too much onto exchanges or clearing houses too quickly. So that tells you something. Given the concentration risk of single CCPs in a product type, there is some support for multiple CCPs. Multiple CCPs, though, means now you've got multiple ways of clearing and risk managing trades, so you don't necessarily have a uniform system for a product globally. Another big picture risk I see is the impact on liquidity. So overall, we're likely to see greater liquidity on OTC derivatives as they become more standardized and transparent, and people are less concerned about counterparty risk and operational risk. But within this overall picture, we will likely move to a scenario where centrally cleared derivatives are more liquid, and tailored trades that are bilaterally cleared are less liquid, as dealers will have to take on the basis of hedging bilateral tailored trades with vanilla centrally cleared trades, and they'll pass their transaction costs back to clients. Very often, tailored trades are requested by clients to serve as hedges for specific positions, or they're used in asset and liability management. So one of the consequences of central clearing is to potentially reduce liquidity and increase the cost of the very hedge trades that motivated OTC derivatives in the first place. One thing I'd also like to highlight is that not enough attention has been paid to the mismatch that dealers face between tailored or legacy trades on one side and centrally cleared trades on the other. These mismatches generate a variety of risk for dealers, including counterparty risk, operational risk, and documentation risk. And again, we'll talk about some of those later.
Julia, thank you for the opportunity to participate and following up on the news points. I would highlight two central risks as we think about centralized clearing, one of which mirrors a news point, and another one which is a more general point. Similarly to Anu, I certainly think we all recognize that there is a concentration risk associated with centralized clearing. In fact, that's obviously part of the vision of the system. One of the pros of centralized clearing is this idea of concentrating within a small group of clearing houses the number of client trades that are available for clearing, which will facilitate netting of margin and centralization of risk management practices. I think the cons, as Anu pointed out, are that it does centralize risk in certain institutions that potentially could become subject to or more vulnerable to systemic risk. And I would also add that there is a potential lack of competition. And when I suggest lack of competition, I think we all recognize lack of competition is problematic as it relates potentially to services being rendered or cost. Certainly, we all don't want to see any competition in the form of risk management procedures. I will say that as a clearing broker, Morgan Stanley works very closely with the clearing houses and the regulators to try to help the system evolve and get to what we hope is the right place in terms of centralized clearing, both in terms of regular dialogue with regulators, as well as participation in various risk committees at the clearinghouses. So hopefully that amount of engagement on our part and on the part of all market participants is something that is helping the system to get to the right place. The second risk that I would highlight at a higher level is the fact that there is potentially a significant degree of execution risk in this new world of clearing. You have a piece of legislation in the U.S., for example, Dodd-Frank, that requires almost 40 sets of substantive rulemakings to facilitate centralized clearing, all of which are being written in parallel. And at the same time, at a high level, it's very important for regulators to balance the costs and benefits of this new system. We hear this regularly voiced by regulators, so clearly it's something that they also recognize and are very much embracing. But let's take, for example, one example, and that is the potential rise in initial margin and the potential rise in guarantee fund contributions or default fund contributions by clearing brokers. Those are two central pools of capital that a clearinghouse will use potentially to stave off any issues in a bankruptcy scenario. The projections are that potentially in the initial margin side, there may be hundreds of billions of additional margin being collected by the clearinghouses. And again, I think we recognize that may be appropriate. However, it will be critical to balance the cost versus the benefit. Potentially, an imprecise balancing may lead to excessive margin being called for certain products, which potentially may make those products very expensive to trade, and potentially impact the liquidity in a market, thereby driving market participants to use alternative instruments and perhaps to choose to hedge imperfectly rather than use and derivatives. So again, this is an evolving process. I think dialogue is critical to get to the right place. But it will be very important for regulators and market participants and CCPs to coordinate and work as best as possible to come up with sensible solutions. And also, there's an international element to that as well across different jurisdictions.
Excellent. Thank you, Andrew and Anu. Let's drill down into some specifics now that we have that overview. Specifically on counterparty risk, this is obviously a big issue going forward, especially with central clearing. And can you guys give us a little bit of an overview as to what the concerns are you have with regards to managing counterparty risk in this new OTC marketplace? And Andrew, would you like to start us off with this one?
Sure. Before I touch on potentially some risks, let me just reiterate some of the benefits of the system. I think, again, this has been a very strategic decision by regulators and by the governments around the world to try to address an issue of that was identified during the crisis. And so as you think about counterparty risk, there are benefits, and we are actually seeing early adoption by certain market participants who do view clearing with very favorable points of view. And I would highlight two central benefits. One is the idea of centralizing counterparty risk, providing more transparency to that risk, as compared to perhaps the more historic model where you had several institutions, multiple institutions, managing risk independently. Some have characterized it as a spider web of trading. There are two different models in the U.S. and the U.K. Which address counterparty risk somewhat differently. In the U.S., you do have this FCM model, which again is a co-option of the futures model, which will allow for all client monies to pass through a bankruptcy remote segregated account and thereby insulate clients from direct exposure to their agent banks. Similarly, you have the evolving rules around asset protection in the U.S., which will actually potentially allow for additional insulation of risk for clients from the more risk mutualization model that's used in the futures model. So there are definitely strategies being implemented in the U.S. To address specifically mitigation of counterparty risk. In the U.K., briefly, there are also important protections for clients, but the system is more in line with a traditional principal model of clearing, and client money protection resides at the clearinghouse level, such as the ACA account structure at LCH. The other area where there are benefits is the uniformity of practice with respect to collateralization of exposure. Whereas in the traditional world, different counterparties had different levels of collateralization being requested. Again, in this new world, you have transparency around collateral against different products, and that will ultimately provide a level of reassurance, hopefully, for the market. Now, the risks, again, in this world, I think come principally from execution risk over the near to medium term. If you think about it, you have a potential risk of fragmentation of the housing of risk in the system. Following the G20 commitment to clearing, you have several different countries that are discussing the prospect of creating domestic clearing solutions. Within those countries, you have multiple clearinghouses that may be accommodating different types of products or competing against one another. And finally, you have what we all recognize will ultimately be a phase-in in terms of what types of products are supported. And so at certain points in time, you may have different products that are in clearing and outside of clearing, products that perhaps traditionally were traded together and may have been netted against each other from a risk perspective. So you may have risk residing in two different places where it did not traditionally. And the phase-in of that process will ultimately be a process that is subject to very careful scrutiny and coordination by clearinghouses and regulators, which will depend importantly on, you know, what is mandated to be cleared at what point in time by regulators, as well as what are CCPs able to support from a risk perspective as well as from a liquidity perspective. All this to say that you have the risk that over the short to medium term, you may have risk residing in different places until such time as clearing has fully centralized, or until such time as it has been decided by various markets that a certain suite of products should be cleared, others should be remain outside of clearing, and people can risk manage around those various situations. So the fragmentation may be something that market participants must manage and be aware of for some time to come.
To add to Andy's point, I'd say that in the current clearing model, we have the CCP facing the largest market participants because they're the ones who meet the large capital requirements for clearing members. So these are mainly the large dealers and the largest buy-side investors. And then each dealer serves either as a client's counterparty in a bilaterally cleared trade or as a clearing broker for a non-clearing member who wants to centrally clear a trade. So if we want to move to the ideal model where the CCP faces market participants directly, each market participant should be a clearing member so that it can face the CCP directly. But that means the capital requirements for clearing members would need to be lowered because ICE and SwapClear both have minimum capital requirements of $5 billion. CME Clearing has a minimum of $500 million on CDS and $1 billion on interest rate swaps. Earlier this year, the CFTC proposed the minimum capital requirement to be capped at $50 million, which sparked huge debate on whether this number was too low. On one side, you had existing clearing members saying that poorly capitalized members are unlikely to be able to meet emergency calls to top up default funds if there was a series of failures, which would weaken the stability and the purpose of a CCP. On the other side, small institutions feel that the high capital requirements are a way for the CCPs and large dealers to keep smaller players out of the profitable clearing space, and also that an institution's capital base is not a good indication of its risk management capabilities. They also argue the more varied the clearing members, the lower the correlation risk for the CCP. My own view is that a $50 million capital requirement is too low, as the default fund does need contribution from clearing members in case of failures, so members do need to be sufficiently capitalized to meet these contributions. But I also think that a $5 billion capital requirement forces the current model that we have, which is not ideal. The correct figure is somewhere in between. Ultimately, it should be up to the CCPs to use objective risk-based tests to determine legibility, as this should be an economic risk-based decision, not a regulatory or a political one.
Okay, excellent. Let's move on to operational risk. I want to discuss some of the operational risks that are inherent in adopting this post-trade processing in a new market structure, including, you know, connectivity and some of the other changes that will need to take place. And Anu, would you like to give us your point of view on what are the most concerns in this area?
Sure. I see three key operational issues. The first is backloading. So the over-the-counter derivatives market is approximately $600 trillion in size, with interest rate derivatives accounting for about 75% of that volume, and credit derivatives accounting for another 5%. Central clearing is a relatively recent initiative, so a large portion of this market is not currently centrally cleared, and there's only so many of these trades that can be backloaded in a short period of time. Market participants are working as hard as they can to keep up to date with the rules and have systems in place to implement them as quickly and smoothly as possible. Backloading adds a whole additional layer of work. And not only in terms of the backloading itself, but also the position that it leaves dealers in. For interdealer trades, backloading reduces each dealer's counterparty risk to the other because both parties are clearing members. For client trades, dealers that act as clearing brokers on backloaded trades will actually be taking exposure to the client where they didn't have this risk before backloading. The second issue I see is novations. Novations are often done on trades that are off-market and sometimes with non-clearing members, which increases a dealer's counterparty risk to the non-clearing member counterparty to whom the trade is being novated. So dealers now have to think about this when giving prices for unwinds in case the client doesn't like that price and novates the trade and puts the dealer into that position. And finally, there's interoperability. So thus far, dealers have looked at their net exposures to each other and to clients across products. So it's possible to net and to determine margin and collateral requirements across products, which is capital efficient. The question is, are the various clearing systems such as DCCC and MarketWire interoperable? If not, and the systems can't report together, then you can't apply cross-margining, and that's a huge loss in terms of netting benefits.
I would just add a couple of things from the Morgan Stanley perspective. One is with respect to certain of Anu's points, there's clearly operational risks that need to be thought about and addressed. Some of her points also touch on some of the potential financial risks or financial implications of certain trades. And I think what we hope to do at Morgan Stanley is have a very open dialogue with our clients regarding things like limits and the economics around trades, and being very transparent about how we see the business and how we see the world evolving, so as to allow clients to be able to assess independently what works for them, as well as to understand our perspective and how we're trying to manage the business. It is very important to us that we think carefully and communicate effectively about any potential contingent funding exposures we have, or how giving certainty to clients where full certainty, so they can manage their book of business, and we can also be responsible in managing ours. The other issue is more tactical in terms of on my team, for example, here in the U.S., we have a set of onboarding staff that is actively engaged. Purely on helping clients to embrace and get up to speed on clearing. This is a technologically intensive process requiring a reworking for most clients of their internal systems, or at least understanding in depth the flows involved. In our case, it typically takes 8 to 12 weeks to onboard a client. A lot of this depends on the engagement of a client and how quickly they want to get up to speed, and we can go faster if necessary. But this is not a trivial exercise, and we have learned quite a bit already from helping some of our early adopters get into full-scale clearing, and we are finding that our lessons learned are very valuable for new clients, and helping them to avoid certain pitfalls as it relates to connectivity, the flows, and a whole host of other issues that we're seeing day-to-day in the clearing space.
Now, we've touched on counterparty risk, but let's move on to collateral management. I'm curious what the risks are that you both see in terms of the changes to collateral management processing, especially within a CCP environment. Now, Andrew, you've already alluded to this with regards to your client clearing offering. Would you like to give us some of your points of view as to what the potential unintended risks or complications are in collateral management going forward?
Sure. I'll talk briefly about three different areas. The first, two of them relate directly to points I've made before. The first relates purely to cross-margining, and again, addressing this risk of fragmentation, where clients may be having, at least for the short to medium term, derivative trades in different parts of a bank, effectively, or may also have more enhanced need for capital efficiency and cash management, given some of the enhanced financial requirements of centralized clearing. In our case, at Morgan Stanley, we have been building a very robust technology solution that will allow clients to optimize cash management and potentially optimize cash management across products all across our balance sheet, effectively. And that really could come in two flavors. One is the idea of margin aggregation. So to the extent that a client may have excess cash in another part of our balance sheet, helping that client optimize the cash usage on our balance sheet before we have to go back to the client and require more cash for a potential margin call. The second flavor relates to portfolio margining, potentially offering financing of margin. And I think we clearly are seeing in the U.S. that portfolio margining most likely will not be an option in the U.S. jurisdiction. However, globally, it's still unclear as to what will be permissible and what will be impermissible. And what we've done is built the maximum technology solution to allow clients potentially to optimize as appropriate under the relevant legal standards as they evolve. The second issue I wanted to briefly touch on was collateral usage. With the enhanced needs around margin, it will be critical for clients to be able to post securities rather than cash for margin. And in this case, one important consideration is the extent to which clearinghouses may potentially liberalize what is eligible in terms of collateral. Now, in our minds, this is entirely a question for regulators and CCPs to work on. And again, it goes back to the point of cost-benefit analysis as to, is there a benefit to accepting more liberal, having more liberal standards of collateral? Can that be addressed by higher haircuts around collateral to account for mark-to-market moves, or is it better to have a narrower available book? But as of now, it is important to note that the CCPs are generally limited in what they can accept in terms of available securities, eligible securities, and even where they can accept eligible securities, they do put hard caps for the moment on how much collateral clearing members can post in those categories. So it's very important for clients to do their due diligence in this context and really understand what are the rules of the road and perhaps getting involved in the conversation as it's still evolving so as to be able to manage their own collateral needs. The final point I would make briefly revolves around funding. This business, not surprisingly, is very heavy, involves a very heavy usage of funding. And often this will be due to the fact that clearinghouses will come in first at the early in the morning each day and debit accounts, and then there will be a need to collect margin from clients. It is very important for clients to do work to ensure that their custodians and or back offices can meet relevant settlement deadlines. What we've seen already is that certain settlement deadlines are sufficiently difficult for clients to meet that effectively they are strained in their capacity to meet same-day calls. And again, that is a significant funding drain on clearing members potentially, and also a significant funding requirement for clients. So we obviously are working very actively with clients to think about solutions to those issues, whether it be around mitigating techniques or just improving in-house standards. But again, that's part of the onboarding process and trying to get to the right place from a financial resource perspective.
Good point, Sandy. And I think to add to the bit that you talked about in terms of funding, I'd add the issue of collateral segregation. So the idea of each party's derivative trades and relevant collateral being segregated from other parties' collateral is good because it addresses the problems we saw post Lehman's bankruptcy. But depending on the collateral segregation model that's used, it may prevent collateral from being commingled and used more efficiently, which means a need for more funds and collateral. The other point that Andy made in terms of the eligibility of securities that can be posted to CCPs. So most CCPs accept only cash or government bonds as eligible securities, whereas a much wider category of collateral has been accepted under CSAs in bilaterally cleared trades. So some clearing brokers are offering collateral transformation services to clients to transform non-eligible securities into eligible collateral to post with the CCP. One of the mechanisms through which clearing brokers can do this is to repo non-eligible collateral and use the cash from the repo as collateral with the CCP. But if there's a big variation margin call, the client doesn't have eligible collateral and there's a freeze in the repo market, the clearing broker could face a big funding risk. We've been in this situation before where markets have suddenly gapped and the repo market has frozen. It was relatively recent, and markets are currently very turbulent, so this risk is not remote.
I would just add to that point. I think those are excellent points, Anu. Again, I think that those points only reinforce the need for very transparent and very active conversation between clearing brokers and clients as to expectations as well as limits, so as to be able to ensure that both parties are comfortable with the clearing arrangements in place.
Okay, great. Now let's briefly discuss legal and documentation. Now obviously there are going to be some changes coming up on the documentation to support these new market structure changes. So Anu, do you want to give us your point of view on what is the most significant changes that our audience should be paying attention to?
Sure. Given the straight-through processing on T0 for centrally cleared trades, there aren't really any legal risks for such trades. So the legal or documentation risks arise due to old or tailored trades with paper confirmations. But they also arise from the mismatch the dealers face between tailored or legacy trades on one side and centrally cleared trades on the other. So there's currently a big mismatch in CSAs. Inter-dealer CSAs are multi-currency, whereas the clearinghouse CSAs are single currency. So dealers with a bilateral trade on one side and a centrally cleared trade on the other side can find themselves in a situation where they may be accepting euro or sterling denominated corporate bonds via the bilateral CSA, but they have to post US dollar cash to the clearinghouse as collateral on a US dollar interest rate swap. In fact, some dealers are refusing backload requests from other banks and clients if it results in a negative NPV for them, or they're asking for compensation in such cases. So not only does this cause counterparty disputes, but it's another hurdle for backloading legacy trades. The market is currently working on a standard CSA, which can be used across all types of trades, but I suspect this will take a while, as CSAs take a long time to negotiate, and there could be a period of time where there continue to be multiple types of CSAs out there.
I would in this context, I would just briefly mention the clearing side, more specifically around legal documentation. In the U.S., for example, to engage in clearing and then work with a clearing broker on clearing or multiple clearing brokers involves the execution of several bounding legal documents, whether that be a FIA addendum that modifies the existing futures contract that may be in place with a clearing broker, a revised execution agreement, compensation agreements in the event to account for the event that a potential clear trade that for whatever reason does not properly clear and must be unwound. Needless to say, it is a significant amount of work. The 8 to 12 week onboarding process that I mentioned earlier in the call, a significant part of that work involves legal negotiation and working through the concepts of the new framework around clearing. At Morgan Stanley, we have a team that works very closely with the client to help the client understand those bespoke developments, as well as to work through the negotiation process, giving some sense of where the market is and how it's evolving. But again, I would encourage active engagement on the part of clients and some budgeting of time for what will inevitably be a time-consuming process in terms of understanding and getting comfortable with the new legal construct for clearing.
Okay. Thank you to our speakers, Anu and Andrew, for sharing their overview of the unintended risks of this new OTC marketplace with us today. If any of the audience has any questions or comment on this topic or on this podcast, please feel free to submit those questions in the comment section at the very bottom of the webpage. We welcome any feedback from our listeners and hope you can join us again soon. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.